Well, it's Ag Policy Radio Thursday. I'm Todd Gleason. This is the Closing Market Report. We're joined in studio this afternoon by Dave Dickey, the Director of Agricultural Programming here at the radio stations. Good afternoon to you, Dave. Glad to have you on board for the afternoon.
Thank you very much, Todd. Good afternoon to you. Look forward to a good discussion on nutritional programming.
You bet. This afternoon, we're joined by Park Wilde, who's with the Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy out of Tufts University. He's in Boston, Massachusetts. Park, we appreciate you joining us this afternoon. Can you tell me very quickly what it is that you've done in your previous life that tells us that you should be here talking about food and nutrition programs?
Actually, I'm trained as an agricultural economist and worked for USDA for several years in their agency that does economics research. So now I'm here as a loan economist in a nutrition school in Boston.
And that's an interesting background. Tell me about how the food and nutrition programs work into the USDA budget overall and what kind of programs there might be available that U.S. citizens take advantage of.
Well, you know, the food assistance programs are actually a large part of the USDA budget. They total over half of the department's budget. It's not exactly the sort of thing the Secretary of Agriculture probably pays attention to on a daily basis. Much of his attention is probably on farm programs and food safety issues. There's about 15 programs, but several of those are pretty small. And so the leading programs you might know are the food stamp program, which helps low-income and vulnerable Americans, the WIC program, which helps women, infants, and children, and the school meals programs, like the school lunch program.
And can you explain a little bit about each of those?
Well, the food stamp program is an entitlement, which means that the federal government sort of guarantees that enough money will be made available for however many eligible people show up to claim whatever benefits they're eligible for. And so to be eligible, you have to be low income. And you also can't have too much assets or too fancy a car. And for the school meals programs, you know, anybody can participate in the school lunch program, but to get free or reduced price meals, you have to be low income. And finally, for the WIC program, the income standard is a little bit higher, so you have to be either low income or sort of medium low income, and you have to fall into the categories. You have to either be a pregnant woman who needs sort of food support or be an infant or a child.
I'd like to think that a lot of these are done on the morality issues, but I know there's cost benefits. How do the accountants take a look at those kinds of programs?
In the sense of how much do people worried about the budget deficit worry about them?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a bit of a concern. The program's supporters feel like they've been doing well in these recent years. For example, the food stamp program has recently switched from using those traditional paper coupons to EBT. And there's also interesting new programs like having these EBTs like debit cards and being able to use these cards in farmers markets. And at the same time, people are really worried about the budget deficit. So there's a sense that there may be threats looming, that there's going to be a temptation to look to these programs for cuts in the next few years.
I would like to talk a little bit about the political scheme. Where do the bulk of the food and nutrition programs get used? If you look at a map of the United States, I know there are some maps on the ERS sites that show heavier usage areas. Where might they be?
Well, they get really they're used all over the country. All of these are national programs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when they first got started in the 70s, not necessarily all states or all counties in each state have them, but now they're pretty much everywhere. And the heaviest use is going to be wherever there's more low-income people. So, for example, in inner cities and also in low-income rural areas.
And as I looked at the maps, it seemed to me that the heaviest use was particularly across the South and completely across the South, which surprised me. I thought the Southeast might not be as heavy a use, but Texas, Louisiana, Georgia,
right.
Even Florida, if I remember correctly, California, Nevada was not in the heaviest used area. But then if you go on up into the Western Plains states, that they were... as a percentage of the population, I think it was.
Right.
It's not total numbers, but as a percentage of the per capita population.
Right, and this is food stamps, because there's also there's a big strip through Appalachia where rates of food stamp use are somewhat higher, and also along the Texas borderlands are quite high, and in heavily Native American areas of the Southwest, for example.
And what I'm driving at is I'm trying to figure out just exactly sometimes the farm lobby has to shake hands or does shake hands with the food nutrition lobby when they're putting together farm bills and USDA budgets and budgets in general, trying to figure out where exactly those politicians might be. Can you tell me, not only the politicians, but because we've identified some of those areas, but who is it that lobbies on behalf of these food nutrition programs?
Right. No, that's an astute question. You know, the coalition between farm state legislators and urban legislators that supported these programs over the years is a very established thing. They're very aware of sort of the mutual benefits. The food stamp program, for example, provides needed food benefits to low-income people in the inner city, but it also helps food retailers and it helps farmers support the demand for their products. And so it doesn't even require any backroom dealing. It's sort of a political combination that people are just very highly aware of in Washington. This combination shows up because the food assistance programs are sort of together with farm programs in the structure of the federal government. They're both there in USDA, as opposed to having food assistance be, for example, in Health and Human Services. And they're also there in the ag committees, because the agriculture committees in Congress have these dual responsibilities. It sort of means the same people are thinking about both types of programs.
Let me reintroduce our guest this afternoon. Park Wilde is joining us from the Friedman School of Nutrition and Science and Policy at Tufts University. He used to work with USDA. Also alongside us this afternoon is Dave Dickey here in the studios. Dave, what are the numbers for the folks to call if they'd like to call in and join our conversation this afternoon?
And we do indeed hope they do, Todd. The phone numbers are 217-333-9455. That's our local number. And 1-800-222-9455. That's good for anywhere you can hear my voice.
All right, Dave, let's continue this discussion. If you want to get in on the discussion, please give us a call. Once again, the numbers are 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. The 9455, of course, stands for WILL, and that is the radio station you're listening to at this time. So if we take a look at the food and nutrition programs, and oftentimes on the farm side, direct payment side, on the kinds of programs that farmers deal with, we talk about food security. And that means food security for the nation, that there be ample food supplies around. But on the food nutrition side, there's a different definition for food security, isn't there?
Right. I mean, sometimes people hear the word food security and they think we're talking about something like homeland security or military security. But actually, the way USDA uses the term household food security refers to whether American families have enough to eat. It's about whether all family members are assured of enough food for an active, healthy life. So in 2003, for example, USDA estimated about 11% of American households showed symptoms of some kind of food insecurity in the past 12 months. And this rate has been rising since about 1999.
And we'll continue with that topic in just a bit, but we do have a caller from Indiana on the line. Good afternoon to you, caller. Do you have a question that you'd like to ask?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thanks a lot for having this kind of program. It's very helpful. You mentioned earlier that I think it was the food stamps, or perhaps it was the entire WIC, et cetera, program, but took a little over 50% of the Department of Agriculture's monies. Is that true?
I think that's correct.
Okay. I'm not, trying to be spiffy, but what concerns me is if it finally came about that they took X amount of dollars from the Department of Agriculture, in the feeling that you would have of it, is it that they would cut all programs the same amount, or would they decide to essentially go after people who don't have lobbyists, which means basically the food stamp people, the WIC people, et cetera? Thanks a lot.
What are your feelings about that particular issue?
If
the budget were so constrained that they would be looking to take an amount out of it, would they go for food and nutrition programs, or would they go for all the programs across the boards?
Right. It's a little hard to say because in general, cuts to either farm programs or to food assistance programs are very difficult. To farm programs, it's difficult because, you know, every state has two senators. All the senators from farm states don't want to see those programs cut. And for food assistance programs, this coalition between rural and urban legislators has been sort of a stable source of support. So I wouldn't want to be in Congress right now facing a hard choice. If they were required to cut something in the USDA budget, I wouldn't know where to start.
Last week we talked with Bob Thompson, who is the Gardner Chair of Ag Policy here at the University of Illinois. And one of the things that he said, not on the air but off the air, but that there was some concern that the farm lobby would bail on the food and nutrition programs this next time around, in his mind at least, and that the two of them have coexisted for a long time and really did need each other to continue to lobby for monies out of the taxpayers' dollars.
Right. I mean, I think that's exactly it. I could totally see the temptation for a supporter of the farm programs to think, hey, maybe food assistance is the place to cut, but there's a danger in that as well. You'd wonder about whether support for the whole pair of issues would decline.
And let me remind you, if you'd like to join our conversation, the number to call is 217-333-9455 locally. Long distance, you can call toll-free, can't you, Dave Dickey, at 800-222-9455.
Indeed you can. And Park, it seems as we're shaping this debate, one of the things that comes to my mind is that we're going to have different leadership discussing what the Farm Bill in 2007 is going to be and then the Farm Bill was in 2002, because many of the most important members of that 2002 Farm Bill debate are gone. Representative Larry Combest, a Texas Republican, he's no longer there. Representative Charlie Stenholm, no longer there. Senator Tom Daschle, no longer there. So at least in my mind, it seems one of the things that we have to keep an eye on is who will emerge as leaders in the Farm Bill debate and what their predilections are toward nutritional programs versus other parts of the Farm Bill.
Right. Yeah, those are very good questions. I almost wish I could ask you the same ones because with so much personality turnover in the agriculture committees, as you mentioned, I'm not even quite sure who's going to be leading the 2007 Farm Bill.
Let's return, if we can. We started in on food security just a bit. And there's a term that gets tossed around in some of the literature that USDA and ERS put out about food security, and they call it food insecurity. You were discussing the differences between food security for the nation and food security for a family. Tell me
right.
What food insecurity might be.
Right. So the way USDA estimates food security and food insecurity is just on a major national survey. It's called the Current Population Survey. It's the same survey they use to figure out the unemployment rate or the poverty rate. And they ask about 18 questions about symptoms of things that might have gone wrong in the past year. Ever in the past year, did you ever have to skip meals because there wasn't enough money to buy food? Or did you ever not have enough to feed your children? Or did your children ever go hungry? And depending on your answers to these 18 questions, you get classified either as it's called food secure or food insecure, or if you have a real severe symptoms of hardship, you could get classified as food insecure with hunger. And so insecure just means you're not secure. And that's what's about 11% of American households.
That's a surprise. I guess to me that seems surprisingly high that larger percentage would be insecure of food, given the food nutrition programs and the food pantries that are available throughout much of the United States.
Right. So it's possible to be a food program participant and to be food insecure. For example, if you receive food stamps, those benefits come once a month, and on average it's about $85 or a little bit higher dollars per person, which isn't for most families enough to support their whole food budget. And so it's possible to be a food program participant, and then when you hear these questions, at any time in the last year did you ever have to skip a meal, that would be true too. So at certain times of month or for certain members of the household, you can be food insecure even if you're getting some kinds of food assistance.
And then those that are hungry are at a different level?
Right. So to be classified as hungry, you pretty much have to be answering some of the most severe questions. Did you ever go a whole day without food? Or did your children go hungry?
And that wouldn't be dieting or fasting or other types. They don't count those types.
In fact, for some of the questions, for several of the questions, they explicitly make clear that it's because you didn't have enough money. And they also, in a question about did you ever in the last year lose weight, they make clear that it is excluding because you were dieting.
You know, how long have food nutrition programs been a part of USDA?
You know, there was a food stamp program in the 1930s during the Depression, but it was discontinued. And then the modern food stamp program dates from the early 1960s. WIC is a little more recent. It's from the 1970s.
And why did it begin?
Why did the program?
Yeah,
you know,
in the 60s. Do you have historical context by which you can tell us what happened?
Yeah, you know, this political coalition that we've been talking about has been behind it from the start. So, in the 50s, there was a major concern with agricultural surpluses, and that was a good deal of the motivation for the initial start of the food stamp program. In fact, in the 30s, a major reason for the food stamp program, in the 30s, it would be fair to say the leading reason was agricultural surpluses, and that the program ended when the surpluses ended. By the 60s, concern for hunger was sort of a equal partner with farm interests during the whole life of the food assistance programs.
When your ag economist friends talk to you, what do they ask you in particular about the food and nutrition programs?
You know, there's a lot of one thing people would like to know is, you know, ag economists always put the question in technical terms. They want to know, for every additional dollar of food stamps, how much more food are people spending,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's the effect that you'd really like to know. If you're a farmer and you're interested in the food assistance programs because you want to see demand for your products increased, you'd like to know that number. For every extra dollar of food stamps, how much more food are people buying? So that's an example.
And do we have that figure?
Yeah, that figure is probably between 15 cents and 30 cents. So for every additional dollar of food stamps, people probably buy 15 to 30 cents more food than they otherwise would.
So for every dollar that the taxpayer is putting into the programs, another 15, it's generating 15%.
Right. And that's a good deal higher than the effect of an additional dollar of cash. So, for example, if cash welfare benefits were increased by a dollar, the benefit in terms of food expenditure wouldn't be as high as if food stamps are increased by a dollar.
And explain the reasons why.
I think it's because people associate their food stamp benefits with food. You know, they partly there's a legal reason, which is that you're not allowed to spend your food stamps on non-food goods, and the hazards of breaking that rule are fairly severe. You can get your benefits cut, or you can get booted from the program.
So,
and even beyond that, though, for households that have food spending higher than that cutoff, it may be that certain people in the household sort of have control of the food budget. Like perhaps the woman in the household gets the food stamps, but if it were additional cash in the household, it would be someone else in the household that would have influence over that. And so food stamps tend to have a distinct and strong impact on food spending.
So is the argument ever made that the food and nutrition programs, not only as far as feeding the populace, are actually appear to be, if they're returning 15%, appear to be a fairly good investment for the taxpayer as well?
Right. I mean, especially if your interest is in the food industry in particular.
That was interesting stuff. I'm glad you brought that up.
I would like to look at food from a slightly different angle there, Park. You know, this year it seems to me that we're going to see increasing food prices. We had the hurricane jolted fruit prices, And some economists are predicting that food prices this year, despite these broad increases in farm prices, might be up about 3 to 4%. And the question I have for you is, if we do see higher food prices this year, what kind of climate does it set for those who will shape the farm bill as they begin to try to discuss on what levels of financial support to peg these nutritional programs?
Right. You know, from the point of view of legislators, there's a few things about an entitlement program like the food stamp program that make them feel a little powerless in a way that makes them feel a little uneasy. For example, the food stamp benefit is indexed with a delay to food prices. So if food prices go up, the benefits may go up. And the control of the legislators is a little bit lowered for another reason, too, which is that if the unemployment rate goes up or if something happens that makes the economy less strong, more people may become eligible. And they may show up at the food stamp office claiming the benefits to which they're entitled. And so the food stamp budget can go up sometimes even without legislators making any appropriation that decided that on purpose. And so I think food prices are a good deal of concern. It puts additional stress on the budget.
So give us your best guess then. It's very early still, but with this federal budget deficit that we're facing, 2004, I guess, around $422 billion, what do you think lawmakers might begin to talk about in terms of shaping this debate?
Well, no one ever sort of goes out on a limb and says, we want to take food away from people. The way it would happen would be in terms of some sort of cap on entitlement spending. So they wouldn't probably target a particular food program on its own. They would say, we're going to have a cap on a certain category of entitlement spending. And if more people show up eligible to claim that benefit, we just need to cut the benefits proportionally. And that's something that supporters of the food programs are quite worried about. But I don't know if it's going to happen or if it has to happen. Remember, even though these are large programs, they're not actually all that large a part of the federal budget. Food stamps, for example, is $27 billion. Other parts of the federal budget are much, much bigger than that.
We do have a caller who is wanting to join the conversation. Good afternoon to you, caller. We appreciate you being on the toll-free line.
Thank you very much. Well, the other factor in this I don't think you've mentioned is the Republican Party, whose stated goal is to eliminate anything that smells like Roosevelt. The food stamp program is one of those, and I'm sure they view it as an entitlement that needs to be gotten rid of. I know that's not all Republicans, but it's certainly the ruling crowd that's in power. And while they used to be friends of the farmers some years ago, I think this will come under their eyes as something we have to get rid of.
Park,
do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, Park, do you have a comment on that? And because you worked in USDA, did you get a feeling that there was certainly Republican and Democrat views on the food nutrition programs?
Right. You know, there might be tendencies that differ, but the tradition over the decades has been for bipartisan support for these programs. For example, Senator Bob Dole was traditionally a major supporter of these programs, and there's others from the Republican side that one can think of. I know that somebody earlier mentioned that there's lobbies for the farm programs but not for the food assistance programs. In fact, that's probably true as a matter of scale, but there are organizations that seek to that keep tabs on the funding for food assistance programs. They include organizations like the Food Research and Action Center in Washington. And groups like that are very careful to be bipartisan, tend not to only speak to Democratic legislators.
Well, if they were to come under attack from one side or the other, and it looked as if those programs were going to be cut, Would it literally be the politicians that represent those areas where usage is heaviest that would come to the aid or not? Or would it just be a bipartisan vote?
Right. Yeah.
Or partisan vote, I should say.
Right. Yeah. So I would worry about partisanship because the partisan lines don't cut exactly the same way as low-income, high-income differences do in this country. And So if it became a highly partisan issue, that could cause trouble. But I almost don't really foresee that happening. Over the years, it's been easier for critics of the social safety net to criticize programs other than these food assistance programs. These food assistance programs have been somewhat protected. I'll give an example. In 1996, when there were major welfare reforms instituted at the federal level, the traditional cash assistance program, which was called AFDC, was canceled entirely and replaced with a new program that wasn't even an entitlement anymore. And there was talk about doing the same thing with food assistance programs, like food stamps, but it didn't happen. The coalition wasn't there to radically scale back food assistance programs the same way it was for cash assistance.
Can you take up one other topic that you, I know, wanted to discuss this afternoon just a bit? And that was obesity. Of course, we had USDA just releasing a new food pyramid, and it included exercise. And then there's been some releases in the last week or so that suggest that people that were a little on the heavier side were okay nutritionally and probably health-wise as well. You had a different take on obesity and how food and nutrition programs work with that particular issue.
Right. Well, I got to tell you, this is something that critics of the program have been aware of, this possibility that perhaps it's not a great idea to give food assistance in an environment where a lot of people are at risk of obesity. It's also something USDA has been very aware of. I know that the Food and Nutrition Service, for example, put out an analysis recently trying to figure out, hey, do we need to worry about this? And their sense was that there's no proof that food assistance contributes to obesity. And that might seem surprising, but there's a couple of reasons why that might be. For one thing, obesity has been hitting people across the income spectrum, right? It's all types of Americans have been at higher risk of obesity in recent years. And for another thing, it's possible to have problems of food shortages and to still have obesity at the same time. You know, you'd think about a very poor country where you didn't have enough food all the time. Well, you probably would never see obesity. But in a country that's a little bit more prosperous, if people occasionally go without food, they have sort of a boom and bust cycle in terms of how much food access they have. You can have a risk of overweight in that situation. In fact, you might even have a higher risk of overweight if you have sort of a boom and bust cycle in how much food you have.
As I read that, I had a question about that. If the once a month or the monthly allotments that are coming out of USDA, does that create that kind of boom and bust cycle for those who are on the programs?
You know, it's a little hard to say. I wouldn't want to overstate the case, but this is something I've done some research on. For example, I've looked at how food spending is spread over the month, and it's got a really sharp peak right after the benefits arrive. I think some of the same people who get food stamps may also not have great access always to good supermarkets right nearby. Transportation may be an issue. There's a number of reasons why people often do a big shopping right after food stamps arrive, and that means, conversely, there may be a time of month where people are short of food.
I suppose that works along with regular pay schedules, too.
It does. In fact, in addition to food stamps, the other place I've seen this researched sometimes has to do with military paychecks. There's talk about how much spending people do in military commissaries shortly after payday, and also with Social Security. Social Security benefits tend to come once a month, and so there are studies of whether that affects people's spending.
Just as a reminder, if you'd like to join our conversation with Park Wilde, please do. The numbers to call are 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Or 1-217-333-9455. That's the local number. If you're in the local area, 333-9455. We have about 4 or 5 minutes yet to spend with Park this afternoon. Park Wilde is with Tufts University out of Boston, Massachusetts. And we do thank you, by the way, for joining us for our Ag Policy Radio series. We appreciate you coming on to talk about these programs. Anything out of the nutrition programs that you want to make sure that we cover before we let you go this afternoon?
No, this has been a very interesting set of questions.
Dave Dickey has another question that he'd like to chime in with as we get through the end of this, and we'll open the mics up for Dave. He's actually got control of the mics as opposed to me this afternoon. If he wanted to talk, he could. So we'll let him join in. Dave?
Thank you very much, Todd. Park, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately about this pending retirement of baby boomers, and I think the Congressional Budget Office recently projected that by the year 2019, we might see that our Social Security Trust Fund will fall below payouts, and that's one piece of news. But I'm wondering, on the margins, to what degree will the retirement of baby boomers impact on nutritional programs?
Well, you know, for one thing, rates of participation among elderly Americans is a topic of a good deal of concern. In addition to the fact that you can't participate if you're not low income, it turns out that a fair number of people who are eligible for a program like food stamps choose not to take up their benefits. And the department isn't always quite sure why. And the group that they're most concerned about is the elderly. The elderly, even if they're eligible, participate at a fairly low rate. And so there's a feeling that as the baby boomers reach retirement age, that there may be concern about people not getting the food assistance to which they're entitled.
So what might be done about that?
You know, they do. In recent years, the food assistance programs have gone from almost discouraging participation unless you really, really want it to doing active outreach. I don't know if in your part of the country, but in some parts of the country, there's billboards on the sides of buses saying, check if you're eligible. You may be eligible for food stamp benefits. Help feed your family. And so outreach like that could be done with the elderly, too. Another thing is by making the food stamp program work better hand-in-hand with other programs like supplemental security income and Social Security, that may encourage more elderly people to participate. For example, if there weren't a lot of additional food stamp paperwork, but you became eligible just because of your participation in Social Security, that would be a great help.
Park, I have a follow-up question from some of the work that I do here locally. And do you find that if in areas where food is distributed centrally as opposed to dispersed throughout a community, and that would be food pantries and USDA both, that there's more participation or less participation in these food and nutrition programs?
Right, meaning thinking of, like, is there a big difference in rural areas or urban areas?
Well, I'm thinking if there's one central point that they can get to the food as opposed to having to find the food at several different points throughout a community.
Right. One of the nice things about the food stamp program is that it works through the normal channels of trade. So the same supermarkets where you buy food, that's where you can use your food stamps. And now that these food stamps are in these debit cards called EBT cards, there's not even a lot of special management that's required for dealing with food stamps. The same's not quite true for programs like WIC. For WIC, sometimes you have to pick up either your WIC vouchers or in some states you have to pick up the actual WIC food yourself in a central location, and then that might be more of an issue.
And go on.
Well, there's also commodity programs where you actually pick up the commodities in bulk. And for those, the location is probably a key issue for deciding whether people are going to participate.
And then finally, as we head into this 2007 Farm Bill debate, what would you think the key issues on the food nutrition side might be?
You know, it's funny. There's a lot of real arcane ways where the legislators can make the program a little bit more friendly or a little bit less friendly. And because the program's an entitlement, these things make a big difference in terms of what the participation rate's going to be. So, for example, if they say, every 3 months, you have to come back in and prove that you're eligible again. That can be a good deal of burden. That might discourage participation. But if they say, if you're a working family, you only have to come in every 6 months or every 9 months and prove your income over again, that would encourage participation. And so little changes like that tend to be argued fairly heavily as food assistance programs go into the Farm Bill.
Park, we appreciate you being with us this afternoon. As usual, time flew by very quickly.
Yeah, it's delightful. Nice to talk to you.
Good. Park Wilde is with the Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy out of Tufts University. He joined us from his office.